Fourth case for argument this morning is Rubel against Pfizer. Mr. Ellis.
May it please the court, my name is Robert Ellis and I represent Pfizer and Park Davis. This appeal tests the validity of a local rule that imposes obligations beyond what is imposed by Congress in removing a case to federal court, beyond what is imposed by any other district court that we're aware of, that if complied with by some defendants has resulted in a waiver of their right to removal, and that itself has been applied inconsistently in the very district court that enacted it.
I think the first thing you need to discuss is whether we have any appellate jurisdiction. The district court remanded this after finding that there was no subject matter jurisdiction, and that, one would think, is that.
Your Honor, the district court did not make a finding on subject matter jurisdiction. The district court remanded the case solely under Local Rule 81.2. That local rule is an
extra. That was the reason why he found the pleadings did not establish subject matter jurisdiction. His conclusion was that subject matter jurisdiction had not been established.
Yes, Your Honor, but if the ruling is based on a factor that a district court is not permitted to consider, an extra statutory judicial rule, as it was here.
And what do you think about our decision in Phoenix Container? We dealt with an identical argument in Phoenix Container and rejected it. It's relied on by your opponent, and I notice that you've chosen not to cite it. This is your opportunity.
Your Honor, this local rule has never been challenged
counsel,
before.
I'm asking you to address Phoenix Container.
Yes, Your Honor, and my addressing of it is that this case is different because the local rule is a very specific requirement.
The holding of Phoenix Container is that if a district court remands for lack of subject matter jurisdiction, we do not look through that to examine the reason why he found no subject matter jurisdiction.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But what you're asking us to do is look through the bottom line to the reason. I'm asking you how that is compatible with Phoenix Container.
Your Honor, we are not asking you to look through a subject matter jurisdiction finding. The court made no reference to Section 1447C in its remand. That, under Thermtron, is the reference that is required in order to trigger the reviewability bar under 1447D. Instead, the district court, in fact, the district court did not make any jurisdictional finding at all below, and there was a reason why. Below, the fact of subject matter jurisdiction on diversity grounds, both the existence of complete diversity and the existence of the amount in controversy requirement were not disputed below.
The district court's conclusion was that the pleadings did not show that the amount in controversy exceeded $75,000. That is a jurisdictional holding. I'm asking you to explain how your position can be reconciled with Phoenix Container. So far, I feel that I'm beating my head against a brick wall. If you want to address it, this is your opportunity.
Yes, Your Honor. And Phoenix Container involved a jurisdictional conclusion. Our position here is that Judge Gettleman's decision was not a jurisdictional conclusion. He did
The last paragraph, he says, because the original complaint contains only a generalized allegation regarding the nature of the plaintiff's injuries, does not specify damages sought by the claim, or any member of the putative class, the claimant's failure to obtain an admission or interrogatory response pursuant compels the state to remand without any doubt. Now, that's a jurisdictional statement.
Your Honor, his conclusion. I'm sorry.
You may be wrong, but I mean, he said that this conclusion is that you have failed to state a federal cause of action.
But what he said was that we failed to comply with the local rule that creates requirements.
Well, that might never go to the rule, whether you fail to comply with the rule or there was no rule. If there's, what he said was that there was no federal jurisdiction because you failed to allege the diversity case.
Well, I think what Thermtron and the cases that have come after Thermtron say is that you can't cloak a non-jurisdictional decision simply by calling it jurisdictional. And
that's obviously right. If the district judge said, I'm lazy, I wish to play golf, so all the cases filed today, I'm going to say there's no jurisdiction, even though actually I've never read the papers. The claim that the ostensible reason was different from the real one would, I suppose, be tenable under Thermtron. But there's no doubt in this case that the ostensible and real reason are that the district court believed that the amount in controversy had not been established.
Well,
the judge had some reasons for believing that, and the whole point of Phoenix Container is that we don't go and look at what they are.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that's what Judge Gettleman...
Once more, say, this is your chance.
Your Honor, I don't think that that's what Judge Gettleman was concluding when he ruled on under the local rule. In fact, his footnotes suggest that
he certainly was not saying, well, I think you have established the amount in controversy, but since in addition to establishing the amount in controversy, you have not complied with the local rule, I'm remanding it. That's certainly not the tenor of his opinion.
No, instead what he said was, it looks like the amount in controversy might be satisfied, but I have no power to make that determination because the local rule precludes me from doing so.
Let me ask you this. You're aware, I'm sure aware of the local rule prior to the decision made by Judge Gettleman.
Yes, Your Honor.
What was the reason that you didn't pursue that?
Your Honor, it's the reason that many defendants who are removing cases, particularly purported class actions, do not follow the local rule. Number one, only about half of the judges in the district court, in the Northern District of Illinois, actually require compliance with the local rule, and there's a reason. Because in these kinds of cases, if you send an interrogatory or a document request to class action plaintiffs' counsel before you remove the case, they will immediately make their complaint non-removable and thwart your ability to remove. It's what the plaintiffs tried to do here even before we served any kind of discovery. They tried to amend their complaint. They associated co-counsel.
Non-removal by keeping it under $75,000.
What they did was they omitted their request for personal injury damages and injunctive relief. They associated experienced class action counsel. They themselves are experienced. I think somebody read the complaint, realized that there was a hook for removal, and said, you better amend the complaint quickly. And we removed the case before they sought leave and obtained leave in the state court in order to get that amendment effective. The sole dispute below wasn't whether the amount in controversy was satisfied or whether diversity jurisdiction existed. The sole dispute below was whether you looked to the original complaint or the amended complaint in determining whether removal was proper. In fact, the fact that they amended the complaint to remove the basis for jurisdiction is evidence that there was the amount of controversy satisfied in the initial pleading. And so the Thermtron exception, if local rule 81.2 were in itself a jurisdictional decision, even in a case where the judge made no jurisdictional determination, it would be insulated from review, period. And that is not what 1447D was intended to do. I'll save the remainder of my time for the rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Ellis. Ms. Brown.
May it please the court, Christy Brown for the plaintiff, Janet Rubel. I think probably the only issue, but certainly the most important in this appeal, is whether or not this case is appealable. It clearly, under this court's ruling in Phoenix Container, is not. This court, the district court, the first thing it did was examine what do we have in front of us to decide how much is that issue in this case. The district court looked at the complaint, saw the references to side effects of the drugs, and concluded that just based on those general allegations with nothing more, there was nothing in the complaint to tell the district court that the amount in controversy was in excess of the jurisdictional limit. That was the basis of the judge's decision. The judge then went on to say, step two, is there anything else here? Did they comply with Local Rule 81.2? Did they obtain an admission of any kind? And the answer was no, and so the judge remanded the case. Counsel made reference to the fact that some judges in the Northern District of Illinois have ignored Local Rule 81.2. In each of those cases, those judges had in front of them something else, an admission, a settlement demand.
Is Local Rule 81.2 still in force?
As far as I know, it is, Your Honor.
As you may know, about 4 years ago, the Judicial Conference required all local rules to be renumbered to match the national rules. The Northern District of Illinois did that. I thought all these old 81.X rules had been repealed.
I don't believe it's been repealed, Your Honor, but I haven't...
Do you know whether this rule was ever submitted to the Judicial Council of the Seventh Circuit for approval?
I do not know whether it was ever submitted to the Judicial Council, Your Honor, so I honestly don't know specifically whether with the renumbering, and this rule clearly appears not to have been renumbered, whether it's still in effect. But whether it's in effect or not, in this case, there was nothing on the face of the complaint to tell the judge that this case was in excess of the jurisdictional limit. The judge's decision, as Your Honor's quoted in the last paragraph, was based on a finding that there was no evidence that this case exceeded, the amount of controversy in this case exceeded the jurisdictional limit. Counsel for the defendant also talked about the fact that if they followed the local rule, if they asked interrogatories, then plaintiff would have an opportunity to go and amend their complaint and stay in state court. But that is exactly what plaintiff is entitled to do. Case after case says a plaintiff can couch their claim as being less than $75,000, even if under the law they may be entitled to more than that. Plaintiff is entitled to pick their jurisdiction in that way.
Now, counsel, under Illinois law, are you limited to the amount, maximum amount stated in your claim as to recover?
Are we limited to the maximum amount of stated in our claim? No, Your Honor, we're not limited under Illinois law. If we had an ad damnum clause in our complaint saying we seek $50,000 in damages for this individual plaintiff, and we go to trial and we prove up in excess of $50,000, we're not limited to the $50,000 amount.
That is, you can amend your complaint after the verdict.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that is why in so many cases like this, and in particularly class cases, plaintiffs just don't state a specific ad damnum amount because it's too early to tell what the damages are going to be. But in this case, the damages as defined by the complaint are how much she paid for the drug.
Is there any downside in practical matter to putting an addendum amount certain in your claim, in your complaint?
I'm not sure there would be a downside other than it would be within the discretion of the judge whether to allow you to amend the complaint to comply with the evidence. The judge may determine
that's a downside if he would.
That is a downside. The judge could determine that you sandbagged the other side, that you put an intentionally low amount in the complaint so that they wouldn't take discovery, they wouldn't get this information. You throw it out there at trial and say this claim is much bigger than we thought it was going to be. The judge could exercise his discretion not to allow you to amend the complaint. So there is a downside. In a class case, it's also a bit cumbersome because, you know, if you allege an individual plaintiff's damages, obviously that's not all you're seeking in the litigation. I don't think the rule in any event, whether it's in effect or not, conflicts with the statute. The rule doesn't conflict with this court's decisions. This court has, in a couple of decisions, said, you know, if a plaintiff wants to make sure they stay in state court, they can stipulate. But in this case, we weren't given the opportunity to stipulate. Any stipulation we made after removal, of course, would have been irrelevant for purposes of these proceedings. We weren't asked to stipulate prior to removal. There was no interrogatory. There was no request to admit. There wasn't even a letter from counsel saying, will you stipulate that your claim is under $75,000? The personal injury, with respect to personal injuries, this case is not about personal injuries. This case is about what she paid for the drug, and the drug was not effective for what it was supposed to be effective. There are side effects mentioned in the complaint, but there's no specific request for relief for those side effects. If you look at the ad damnum clause, it's not seeking personal injury damages. In any event, the district court found that even if it was seeking personal injury damages, the allegations did not support a conclusion that the jurisdictional limit had been met. The history of the amendments to the jurisdictional statute, to Section 1447, confirms that any defect that in the removal procedure is what is not appealable. If what the trial court is doing is saying, I'm finding that I don't have jurisdiction under the jurisdictional statute, then that decision is not appealable. The decisions that have been found appealable are where a district court goes completely beyond the jurisdictional statute, says, even if I do have jurisdiction in this case, I'm not going to exercise it for some completely separate reason, such as, I think you'll get a faster trial in state court, or I believe the abstention doctrine prohibits me from exercising jurisdiction, even though otherwise I would have jurisdiction. Or there's a sanction in place against this particular plaintiff, prohibiting this person from filing a case in federal court. Even though I think I have jurisdiction of the case, if I exercise that, am I violating another order of the appellate court? Those are the situations that are appealable, and they're appealable because what the district court has done is not that I don't have jurisdiction over this claim, but that I have jurisdiction under the law, but I'm not going to exercise it. And that's something that obviously the district court doesn't really have discretion to do. Those are the cases that have been appealable. This case, in any event, was not removable. There was no specific ad damnum clause in the complaint. There's no claim for relief for these supposed personal injuries alleged. The plaintiff's attempt to amend the complaint, we amended the complaint prior to removal, but the district court found that we would have had to request leave of the state court in order to appeal that complaint. The only evidence the district court had about plaintiff's intentions, they didn't have a stipulation, didn't have a pre-settlement demand, a pre-suit demand, they didn't have any of those things that some of the other district courts have had. What the district court had here was the only statement of plaintiff's intention beyond the complaint was the amended complaint, which clearly was designed to limit this case, to make it clear that there were no personal injury claims in the case, to make it clear that the district court didn't have jurisdiction. So the district court did not err in making a decision to remand this case. You can't aggregate the plaintiff's claims, whether the plaintiff's claiming punitive damages in this case, the injunctive relief of disgorgement, compensatory damages. It's very clear under this court's decision in Anthony versus Security Pacific that those claims cannot be aggregated for the whole class in order to determine that the district court had jurisdiction over this case. But first and foremost, this case is simply not subject to review by this court, with all due respect. The district court made a finding that it did not have jurisdiction under the diversity jurisdiction statute and remanded the case on that basis. That is the type of decision, exactly the type of decision, that is not reviewable. It's not reviewable because if it is, what happens is what's happening in this case. Instead of getting to the case, we go on and on and on about where the case should be heard. All jurisdictions are supposed to be equal in terms of your ability to get a fair trial. The state court jurisdiction in this case was equally fair to both sides. There was no reason to perpetuate a jurisdictional issue.
So why are you fighting to be in state court?
We originally
both sides to this case must perceive that there's some difference.
The only difference that we perceive, Your Honor, is that this is a class action brought under Illinois state law, and the state court obviously is in the best position to interpret and apply state law, and that this court case properly belongs in state court. It doesn't properly belong tying up the federal courts. It's a state law claim.
I don't think the reason you moved to remand was to vindicate some abstract principle about federalism. I assume you moved to remand because you thought you'd be better off in state court.
We thought we'd be better off having the state court judge apply the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act, because that is what they do every day.
To an out-of-state defendant.
To an out-of-state
that is
defendant.
The Illinois usual consumer reason for why
Illinois consumer
out-of-state people want to remove.
I understand that, Your Honor, and if the case had met the jurisdiction.
It's okay to do it. You can have a terrible motivation as long as you're on sound legal grounds.
And the Illinois state courts have found that the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act absolutely applies to out-of-state defendants.
Mm-hmm.
So they're subject to that statute if they do business here, which they did.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Ellis?
Very briefly, Your Honor. First on the issue.
Your lights will assure that.
Yes, sir.
on the issue of the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act. This case is brought not only under the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act, but the Consumer Fraud Act of every other state other than California. But we're not here today to discuss the propriety of nationwide class certification under consumer fraud statutes. The district court's decision, and Judge Bowery, you referenced the last paragraph. Nowhere in that last paragraph does the judge mention jurisdiction. He just mentioned failure to comply with the local rule. As for the stipulation, this court's ruling in Ray Shell Oil makes it clear exactly when plaintiffs have the ability to file their stipulation, and that's when they file their complaint. Litigants who want to prevent removal must file a binding stipulation or affidavit with their complaint. That was not done here.
Counsel, do you know if these current or this rule is currently in effect?
Your Honor, it is still in the book. It is enforced.
I just downloaded it from the Northern District's website. They think it's still in effect.
And Your Honor, in terms of the renumbering, it used to be Local Rule 3, I believe, and the renumbering went to Local Rule 81 about the time that the review of the local rule. So I think it changed. The renumbering was 3 to 81.2.
From one improper number to another.
And an improper rule in our view, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.